Welcome to another episode of the Maine Humanities Council's Humanities on Demand podcast series. In this talk, delivered on March 7th as part of Winter Weekend 2014, Robin Miller presents Crime and Punishment, the Hum and Buzz of Implication. Robin Miller is a professor of the humanities at Brandeis University. She teaches and studies the fiction of writers in the 19th century, with a focus on Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, and Dickens.
The title of my talk is Crime and Punishment, the Hum and Buzz of Implication. And that's a phrase from the great old Lionel Trilling from an essay of his of long ago called Manners, Morals, and the Novel. And I have three epigraphs for my remarks today. And I've been asked to speak for about 45 minutes, so you'll have to listen for about 45 minutes, and if you finish first, you can raise your hand. So my epigraphs are these. Every man needs air, 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 more than anything. That's from Svidrig Island. Yesterday, somebody said to me that a man needs air, air, air. I must go to him at once and find out what he means by that. That's Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment. And finally, do what justice demands. I know you do not believe me, but it is the sacred truth that life will sustain you. Afterwards, you will regain your self-esteem. Now you need only air, air, air. And that's Porfiry Petrovich. Novels exist on the private space of the printed page, but they are transformed and reincarnated by the imaginations of each reader, each of you. They also find existence through conversation and discussion, such as we will engage in over the next 2 days at this remarkable gathering organized by the Maine Humanities Council. As we gather to discuss this novel, we will inevitably rethink it in some organic way. Such conversations and discussions, while not real performances of the novel per se, do contain aspects of the performative in that the work, for the duration of the time that it is under discussion, lives a life in the words and gestures of its simultaneous readers, us. At these moments, it is literally in play, in the air, much like the many conversations in which Raskolnikov partakes or the snatches of conversations that he overhears. Works of imaginative literature have a public as well as a private existence. Dostoevsky lived much of his life in the public sphere. He valued and participated in the debates about his own work within it. He regarded his fiction as literally connected to recent events in the past, the present, and the future. Moreover, Crime and Punishment is a novel which is about the swirl of ideas and words in the air. For the most part, the notoriously stifling and constrictive air of St. Petersburg in the summer. The briefest of excursions into contemporary culture reveals that our world is in its own ways as rife with disease, extremism, ideology, and despair as the worlds that Dostoevsky commonly depicts. Today's virgin readers of Crime and Punishment, like the novel's original readers in 1866 and 1867, still find themselves unnervingly alive to this work, still fevered by it, still shocked, despite our nearly daily and perhaps desensitizing television immersion in police, mob, and crime dramas. Why does this novel continue to exert this force? If ours is a society where the reading of literary work is in fact at risk, will fictions like Crime and Punishment continue to be read? Will they help to keep reading alive? Dostoevsky would not have hesitated to ask practical questions like this, nor should we. Is reading at risk? In the United States, I would argue that it is. A decade ago, in June 2004, the National Endowment for the Arts issued a report entitled Reading at Risk. Its report, an exhaustive one, is based on a large sampling over time and was conducted by the U.S. Bureau of Census. 17,000 adults from most demographic groups were polled. The results are sobering, to say the least. The report reads, and it is 10 years old, for the first time in modern history, less than half of the adult population now reads literature. And these These trends reflect a larger decline in other sorts of reading. It finds that the rate of decline has accelerated, especially among the young, and gloomily concludes more than reading is at stake. Reading at Risk cites the ways in which print culture affords irreplaceable forms of focused attention and contemplation that make complex communications and insights possible. To lose such intellectual capability and the many sorts of human continuity it allows would constitute a vast cultural impoverishment. The data unambiguously show that people who read also play a more active role in their communities. And I'm sure that's true for virtually everyone in this room. I will certainly bet a penny about this group here. This may contradict our traditional notion of the reader as someone solitary who escapes society through the intensely private, often intimate act, often subversive act, of reading. A decline in reading, in fact, parallels a larger retreat from participation in civic and cultural life. The long-term implications of this study not only affect literature, but all the arts, as well as social activities such as volunteerism, philanthropy, and even political engagement. As more Americans lose this capability, our nation becomes less informed, active, and independent-minded. These are not qualities that a free or productive society can afford to lose. Finally, as if this were not bad enough, the report projects that at the current rate of loss, literary reading as a leisure activity will virtually disappear in half a century. Let's hope that this is an overstatement, and I'm sure it is. But nevertheless, the Pew Research Center reported as recently as mid-January of this year, 2014, so we're 10 years later now, that, quote, nearly a quarter of American adults had not read a single book in the past year. As in, to quote Charles Blow of the New York Times on January 24th of this year, they hadn't cracked a paperback, fired up a Kindle, or even hit play on an audiobook while in the car. The number of non-book readers has nearly tripled since 1978, unquote. Blow goes on to report that not unexpectedly, women were more likely to read than men, but also, and this I found extremely interesting, that blacks were more likely to have read a book than whites or Hispanics. People aged 18 to 29 were more likely to have read a book than any other age group. And there was little difference in readership among urban, suburban, and rural populations. He concludes, but reading text is not the same as reading a text. There is no intellectual equivalent to allowing oneself the time and space to get lost in another person's mind, because in so doing, we find ourselves. Okay. So now I will turn to the novel, but I just wanted to put that little spiel out there. I've divided my remarks today into six parts. First of all, finding an analogy, the novel as tragedy. Crime and Punishment is the most tautly structured of Dostoevsky's novels. With the possible exception of The Brothers Karamazov, his other works do not exhibit the same luminescence of architectural design. The British critic, Malcolm V. Jones, has put it this way. He says, although the novel takes the hero through successive scenes of disorder from which he only occasionally finds release, the plot itself is, by Dostoevskian standards, a relatively orderly one. To illustrate this point, I'm going to turn to Konstantin Machulsky's delightfully old-fashioned volume, Dostoevsky, His Life and Work, from the 1960s. Written, I'm sure, before a number of you were born. Machulsky argues that Crime and Punishment is he calls it a tragedy in five acts with a prologue and an epilogue. Others have also made this link to tragedy. Vyacheslav Ivanov first and famously called Dostoevsky's novels novel tragedies. And more recently, Dostoevsky's great biographer, Joseph Frank, has maintained that this novel elevates the Russian nihilist to artistic heights, equaling the greatest creations of Greek and Elizabethan tragedy. So, think about that. Now, let's test or at least play with Machulsky's hypothesis that the novel is a tragedy in Kuchulski suggests that part one is the prologue, which depicts the preparation and perpetration of the crime. Part two of the novel is then, in his scheme, act one. It portrays the immediate effects of the crime upon Raskolnikov. In part three, Machulsky's act two, Raskolnikov realizes that Porfiry Petrovich suspects him, and he also has the dream in which he tries to kill the old woman again, but finds that despite the blows of his axe, she remains alive and laughs at him. Machulsky locates the climax of the novel tragedy in part four, his act three, in the counterpoint between Raskolnikov's interactions with Svidrigailov, the bathhouse with its spiders, and Sonya, the resurrection of Lazarus. Machulsky identifies an unexpected peripeteia in the painter Nikolai's confession at the very moment when Porfiry had intended to expose Raskolnikov as the murderer. Part five, Machulsky's act four, contains the scandalous scene of Marmeladov's funeral dinner. Raskolnikov's realization, what, was it really the old woman I killed? I killed myself. And his confession to Sonya. These scenes, important though they are, also serve to create what Machulsky calls a crucial slowing of the action before the final catastrophe. That catastrophe occurs in his fifth act, part six of the novel. It's here that Dostoevsky depicts what Machulsky labels as the, quote, parallel ruin of two strong individuals, Raskolnikov and Svidrigailov, unquote. Machulsky does not grant that Raskolnikov is undergoing any kind of spiritual change, even at this late point in the novel. On the contrary, he asserts that Raskolnikov does not have enough strength of will to commit suicide, and so he surrenders himself to the authorities. This is not a sign of penitence, Machulsky says, but of pusillanimity. Finally, in his scheme, the tragedy ends with an epilogue that Machulsky passionately maintains betrays the thrust of the novel as a whole. He concludes, the novel ends with a vague anticipation of the hero's renewal. It is promised, but it is not shown. We know Raskolnikov too well, says Machulsky, to believe this pious lie. Do you agree? Certainly Machulsky casts a kind of order, a semi-familiar structure, that of a tragedy, onto a large mass of turbulent, difficult, often self-contradictory events and utterances. Indeed, although Crime and Punishment is Dostoevsky's most single-mindedly constructed novel, and though it may be the most carefully stitched fiction he ever produced, the construction is more like a hem stitch than a woven tapestry. Tug on one thread and you may begin to unravel or at least reconfigure the whole fabric. For example, Raskolnikov drops a pair of earrings after the crime. The young man who picks them up finds himself swirled into the central vortex of events. If a reader begins to focus on a particular event with microscopic intensity, the shape of the whole alters. Choose almost any action, coincidence, or item at random from the novel, and it will offer a link to something else. The pattern on the kaleidoscope will change, as will the perspective of the whole. Thus, Machulsky's accessible comparison of the structure of the novel with a tragedy offers a simple way to begin to talk about the organization of the novel. Nevertheless, he embeds an idiosyncratic, subversive, even cynical interpretation in his orderly description of the novel. He finds Raskolnikov's conversion in the epilogue to be largely bogus, a pious lie on the part of an author opportunistically eager to get his novel accepted by his readers and by his editor, Pat Koff's thick journal. Is he suggesting, then, that the novel's omniscient narrator is at worst a liar and at best unreliable? He hypothesizes that Raskolnikov's primary emotion is not repentance or even regret, but shame. Raskolnikov is, above all, ashamed because he had come to his ruin, quote, blindly and stupidly. Machulsky's highlighting of Raskolnikov's persistent sense of shame is crucial to his argument. Shame functions, in his view, as a kind of roadblock to any real repentance on Raskolnikov's part. Surely, some of you might argue that Mochulsky is wrong. Wrong about the structure, wrong about the nature of Raskolnikov's experience, and wrong about the author's reasons for writing his epilogue. Dostoevsky's letters actually chronicle his own surprise that the planned longer ending to his novel had evolved into a short epilogue. Usually his works turned out to be lengthier than he had planned, but in this case, the last part grew shorter. Part two, the portability of readerly insight. Surely Dostoevsky, the master of polyphony, you have some Bakhtin there, the seeker after a new word, he wanted to believe that he spoke a new word, the author of The Diary of a Writer, the avid correspondent, the writer whose every utterance is dialogic, the poet of ideas in the air, would encourage our free-flowing discussion of his work here in Maine in 2014, would consider it an organic part of his work, its existence in the air, in the atmosphere beyond the printed page. Possession of a novel by a reader is essentially a private individual act, but reading and discussing such works also serves a more public civic function and can be important for our lives as citizens in the public sphere. Our responses as readers are partly formative of the entire ecosystem of culture. Recently, the American philosopher Martha Nussbaum has explored the ways in which literature and our readings of it form an essential component of our public discourse and, by extension, our democratic society. Nussbaum argues that thinking about narrative literature has what she says the potential to make a contribution to the law in particular and to public reasoning generally. Her search for a vehicle that allows one to empathize, to understand, quote, the other, is no sentimental endeavor. The capacity that literature engenders in us to understand not only ourselves, but those different from ourselves, can contribute, she argues, to the rational formulation of just law and policy, what she calls an ethics of impartial respect for human dignity will fail to engage real human beings unless they are made capable of entering imaginatively into the lives of distant others and to have emotions related to that participation. As readers of Crime and Punishment, we enter emotionally into the lives of distant others, but also realize and necessarily contemplate the importance of society's rules and decision procedures. Indeed, to read Crime and Punishment is to make a perpetual series of journeys back and forth between the intensely private sphere of Raskolnikov's individual consciousness and the communal realm of laws, ideas, religion, and the population and air of the city that always surrounds and permeates him, all of which you will hear more about tomorrow. More particularly, Nussbaum goes on to argue that the genre of the novel, on account of some general features of its structure, generally constructs empathy and compassion in ways highly relevant to citizenship. Even at the moments of his most private reverie, his dreams or the narrator's representations of the flowing fragmented particles of his hero's consciousness, Raskolnikov is always rubbing up against the values and practices of the world in which he lives. The novel offers its readers innumerable fictional opportunities to contemplate the overlap and the friction between the individual and social justice and to make weighty judgments about both individuals and society. Our capacities of fancy and sympathy are taxed when we read Crime and Punishment. Each of us arrives at our own notion of poetic justice in the world. If we adhere to Nussbaum's point of view, we can argue that this readerly knowledge is portable and can render us more capable of making rational, ethical judgments in the real world. Now, whether we first read Crime and Punishment as adolescents or as adults, most of us are gripped by it. The British critic and short story writer V.S. Pritchett wrote incisively of Dostoevsky that he is still the master because he moves forward with us as the sense of our own danger changes. And the Mexican poet and author Octavio Paz, in a different context, has concurred. Dostoevsky is our great contemporary. These statements could serve as epigraphs for Crime and Punishment. Our present sense of danger is particularly alert these days to the ways in which ideas, half-baked or otherwise, spread in the same way that fearsome viruses travel through the world. The air is their medium. In this novel, Dostoevsky, with his typical novelistic economy, has prophetically conjoined the two. Ideas are viruses. Viruses are ideas. They are equally contagious, and they are both airborne. In the epilogue that Machulsky dismisses so angrily and with such contempt, but of which Dostoevsky was so proud, is the description of Raskolnikov's final and unforgettable dream, a dream that Raskolnikov has near Easter. He had dreamt in his illness that the whole world was condemned to fall victim to a terrible unknown pestilence which was moving on Europe out of the depths of Asia. All were destined to perish except a chosen few, a very few. There had appeared a new strain of trichinae, microscopic creatures with intelligence and will. People who were infected immediately became like men possessed and out of their minds. But never, never had any men thought themselves so wise and so unshakable in the truth as those who were attacked. What is our current age but one in which each of us, whatever our nationality, race, or profession, has been exposed to and very likely infected with precisely such a virus? Moreover, the very language of Raskolnikov's dream, with its references to the chosen few, suggests that he has already been infected. The specters of very real infectious microorganisms, contagions, and the virus of ideology merge here for a contemporary reader in a way that Dostoevsky would undoubtedly have relished, since he was, above all, a poet in prose of ideas in the air. The virus that Raskolnikov imagines is a disease in which absolute certainty, conviction, is paradoxically laced through with uncertainty, anxiety. It's a commonplace that most ideas or items in Dostoevsky's world have a positive and a negative charge. In this dream, in the epilogue, each individual stricken with the virus thought himself wise and unshakably possessed of the truth. Nevertheless, quote, all were full of anxiety and none could understand any other. Each thought he was the sole repository of truth and was tormented when he looked at the others, beat his breast, wrung his hands, and wept. They could not agree what was evil and what was good. They did not know whom to condemn or whom to acquit. The collective judgments necessarily made by any society had become impossible. The individuals in Raskolnikov's dream lacked the crucial ability to make the kind of informed judgments that Nussbaum has described as being an essential feature of citizenry. To re-paraphrase her, they are unable to think of and for the whole rather than as a partisan of some particular group or faction. Is Raskolnikov's dream in prison a representation of the most absolute ideology being wrapped up in a paralyzing mantle of relativity and undirected, unproductive sympathy? Or is this visionary dream of a world simply barren of conviction, of empathy, without justice, poetic or otherwise? Both alternatives are dreadful. Passages like these speak to our own contemporary and confusing sense danger, physical and ethical, in a powerful way. Moreover, although this novel has its epilogue, Dostoevsky still manages, as he virtually does in all of his work, to frustrate our expectation of an ending. We hear nothing of the reassuring hammering and banging that accompanies the endings of most 19th century big blockbuster novels. I'm thinking here of E.M. Forster's remark in his old book, Aspects of the Novel, from 1927. The writer, poor fellow, must be allowed to finish up somehow. He has his living to get like anyone else, so no wonder nothing is heard but hammering and screwing. Our novel may indeed have offered up to us something like a prologue, five acts of a tragedy, and an epilogue, Despite that formal exterior pattern, there is no inner closure, no answer to any single important question. Questions like, why did Raskolnikov commit murder? Or at what moment did he begin to repent his crime? Or what constitutes an authentic confession? Or does Raskolnikov undergo a religious conversion? All these questions are fully ripe for discussion, but never for a full solution. Is ripeness all? Throughout Dostoevsky's canon, the more closely one looks at any possible event or motivation, the more important its precursors seem to become. Yet such are precisely the paradoxes we expect from our most deeply engaging literature. Just as Maynard Mack said of King Lear that, quote, the bent of the play is mythic. It abandons verisimilitude to find out truth. So perhaps we could say of Crime and Punishment that it abandons answers to find understanding. Part four, I'm getting it. The after effects of an unwritten novel and a discarded narrative. In addition to his many published works, Dostoevsky had several unwritten novels, including one called Fathers and Children, The Life of a Great Sinner, and most important for us, The Drunkards, which hovers behind Crime and Punishment. In 1865, Dostoevsky wrote a few lines in his notebooks describing The Drunkards. Here's a little dialogue he jotted down. We drink because there's nothing to do. You lie. It's because there's no morality. Yes, and there's no morality because for a long time, 150 years, there's been nothing to do. Unquote. Most critics, including Frank, have concluded that this unwritten novel expends itself into the Marmolada subplot. Personally, I'm not so sure. The Drunkards may be less unwritten than we tend to think. In fact, the ramifications of drunkenness, and Dostoevsky had used this very phrase, ramifications of drunkenness, when he first mentioned his intention to write The Drunkards, permeate this novel in a variety of ways. They are not neatly confined to the Marmolada subplot. In June 1865, Dostoevsky had written to a prospective editor of his current plan, my novel is called The Drunkards and will be in connection with the current question of drunkenness. Not just the question of analyzed, but also represented are all its ramifications, primarily pictures of families, the raising of children in that environment, and so on and so forth. Sometime during the late fall of 1865, Dostoevsky had reincarnated this plan and had infused it into Crime and Punishment. Although we tend to think of this as a novel about crime and about punishment, it is equally a family novel. And there are vivid pictures of families and of the raising of children in that environment. There are four families at its center, the murdered pawnbroker and her sister, the Raskolnikov family, the Marmolada family, the Svidrigailov family. There are several other families at the periphery. The theme of drunkenness extends well beyond the Marmolada subplot. The Petersburg streets that Raskolnikov wanders abound with drunkards, male and female, young and old, as does his dream of the beating of the horse, which takes place in a rural setting. In one of his earliest notes, we learn that Zamyatov got Raskolnikov, quote, to drink like a pig. But what is more interesting, even the novel's most positive male character, Razumihin, whose name denotes reason and balance, is a drinker. The notebooks for the novels repeatedly emphasize Razumihin's propensity for drink. Most extended passages about him in the notes also contain some mention of alcohol. He drinks two bottles of beer, for example, while trying to spoon-feed Raskolnikov's soup. In fact, at one point, Dostoevsky suggests that Razumihin is extremely worried by the fact that, while drunk, he let out to Raskolnikov that he was suspected of the murder, unquote. In his most extended notebook characterization plan for Razumihin, Dostoevsky writes, Razumihin has a very strong nature, and as often happens with such strong natures, he submits completely to Dunya. Note bene, this trait too is often met among people who, though most noble and generous, are rough carousers and have seen much dirt. Dostoevsky is at pains in this plan, and of course these are just plans, they're not what we actually have, to emphasize was Razumihin's tendency to drink, noting that after a quarrel with Dunya about Sonia, he went on a spree. And finally, nota bene, Razumihin took to drink. She herself came to him, to the drunkard, "What a fine guy you are, and you're not going to drink." "I will." "What a little devil you are. You are worth 15,000 to me now, you know. I'm going to bite your little finger." He bites it very hard. Such were the thoughts about Razumihin at the very time that the novel was actually beginning to appear in the Russian Messenger. Dostoevsky was prepared to have one of his most positive characters be a heavy drinker. The reader, then, can make no easy equation between drinking and moral weakness. How can we discuss an unwritten novel? Or did Dostoevsky in some way end up writing this particular novel after all? Raskolnikov seems to carry out the murders in a state of spiritual drunkenness. He is drunk, as it were, on his ideas. Joseph Frank calls our attention to the fact that, quote, "No one has noted, so far as my knowledge goes, the analogy that exists between Raskolnikov's psychology before and after the crime with Dostoevsky's description of what frequently occurred in the case of real-life peasant murderers. Such a peasant, house, serf, soldier, or workman, often has lived in peace for most of his life. But suddenly, at a certain point, something in him seems to snap. His patience gave way, and he sticks a knife into his enemy and oppressor. The man is, as it were, underlined, drunk, in delirium. It is as though, once having overstepped the sacred limit, he begins to revel in the fact that nothing is sacred to him. Frank's insight here is acute, and he convincingly links the intellectual student Raskolnikov to the gallery of peasant convict murderers Raskolnikov had encountered in Siberia. The themes of family, alcohol, and addiction are potent ones for us. Dostoevsky's representation of these themes, both in his plan for the drunkards and in Crime and Punishment, is subtle, unpredictable, and far from formulaic. For all the ideological eccentricity of Tolstoy's reading of Crime and Punishment, it is, in this regard, extraordinarily incisive. He writes in an odd essay entitled, "Why Do Men Stupefy Themselves?" He writes about Raskolnikov, and he writes, "Raskolnikov did not live his true life when he murdered the old woman or her sister. When murdering the old woman herself, and still more when murdering her sister, he did not live his true life, but acted like a machine, doing what he could not help doing, discharging the cartridge with which he had long been loaded. He lived his true life when he was lying on the sofa in his room, deliberating not at all about the old woman, nor even as to whether it is or is not permissible at the will of one man to wipe from the face of the earth another." And he underlines this. "The question was decided when he was doing nothing and was only thinking, when only his consciousness was active. And in that consciousness, tiny, tiny alterations were taking place. It is at such times that one needs the greatest clearness to decide correctly the questions that have arisen. And it is just then that one glass of beer or one cigarette may prevent the solution of the question, may postpone the decision, stifle the voice of conscience, and prompt a decision of the question in favor of the lower animal nature, as was the case with Raskolnikov." Although Tolstoy probably never knew of Dostoevsky's intention to write a novel called The Drunkards, he would seem to concur that Dostoevsky had managed to write the novel after all, but with a different title. There's something else about the genesis of this novel that I would like to mention to you. Dostoevsky originally conceived this novel as a first-person narrative, which would have possessed, as evidenced by the notes for the novel, all the ambiguities of point of view and audience that Notes from Underground, his short novel of 1864, had exhibited. As you read part one, could you discern any lurking vestiges of this first-person narration? If you recall, much of the narration comes to us through actual conversation, through crucial snatches of overheard conversation, through interior monologue, dreams, and the reading and subsequent deconstruction of a letter even though the actual narrative is in the third person. Once Dostoevsky discovered this third person narrator, he described him in his notebook in the following way. Rummage through all the questions in this novel, but the plot's structure is such that the story underlying must be narrated by the author and not by the hero. If it is to be a confession, then everything must be made clear to the utter extreme. If it's a confession, that means it would be in the first person. And if it were, then everything would have to be made clear. For some reason, Dostoevsky here associated the need for clarity with a first-person confessional mode. It is not logically evident why, if it is to be a confession, then everything must be made clear to the utter extreme. It's not logical, but as we see in Dostoevsky's mind, this was the case. His train of thought in this passage continues. If it is not to be a confessional narrative, but rather one from the author, the shape of the whole text changes. And he writes, another plan, narration from the point of view of the author, a sort of invisible but omniscient being who doesn't leave his hero even for a moment in the book. There is speculation about when Dostoevsky actually made this shift from first to third person in the narration, though we do know that it occurred sometime in the late fall and early winter of 1865, most likely in November. Moreover, in the letters up till November of 1865, Dostoevsky consistently referred to his work in progress as a story. After that, it becomes a novel. The shift in narrative voice coincided with a fundamental generic shift from story to novel. It's particularly interesting that when Dostoevsky first wrote about Crime and Punishment, he described the work as, above all, about a young man who succumbs to the unfinished ideas in the air. In September, he had written to his editor, Chuck Koff, that the action of the story is contemporary, that it is about a young man who yields to certain strange, unfinished ideas floating in the air. Throughout this letter, as well as in another letter to a friend, he continued to refer to the work as a story. In letters written in November 1865, however, the designation changes. The story had become a novel. From here on, all references that I have found in the letters to Crime and Punishment are to a novel. Curiously, he wrote in February 1866 to his friend of the work's genesis in the following way. At the end of November, much had been written and was ready. I burned it all. I can confess that now. I didn't like it myself. A new form, a new plan excited me, and I started all over again. Yet, as we can see from his other letters, and to some degree from the notebook, whose entries are difficult to date, the important conceptual change had actually occurred in early November, when he began to describe his work as a novel instead of a story. Moreover, Frank points out that having decided to recast his novel in the third person, Dostoevsky began to write from scratch. But he did not, according to Frank, burn everything he had written earlier. On the contrary, he was easily able to integrate sections of the earlier manuscript into his final text, simply by shifting them from the first to the third person. Why might Dostoevsky have made this shift? By abandoning the first-person confessional mode, Dostoevsky could, to some degree, escape the claustrophobic air of Raskolnikov's psyche, which he felt he had needed from within to somehow make clear to the reader. It had become impossible to accomplish this. Most important, in my view, for some unknown reason, switching to a third-person narrator also released Dostoevsky from the task he had set himself of identifying a primary motivation for Raskolnikov's ghastly crime. With the switch to a third-person narrative, he simultaneously put that task aside. In the earlier parts of the notebooks, Dostoevsky had repeatedly asked himself, why had Raskolnikov committed the murder? The possible motivations, all again important foci, are many. The Pierre Goriot riddle, the idea of Rastignac, the desire of Raskolnikov to test himself, to see if he was a great man, a Napoleon, or a lass, the awful pressure of his family situation, his immediate physical impoverishment, the devil, the list of possible motivations for his crime goes on and on. And in the early drafts, Dostoevsky's abrupt shift in narrative seems oddly to have paralleled a vital conceptual shift in the creation of both the novel proper and the hero. During the time that the novel was still in the first person, he seemed more intent upon finding a definite, particular answer to that question of why Raskolnikov committed murder, an answer that would outweigh other answers. He writes to himself, underlined, the chief anatomy of the novel. It is absolutely necessary to establish the course of things firmly and clearly and to eliminate what is vague, that is, explain the whole murder in one way or another and make its character clear. The early notebooks for the novel document Dostoevsky's frustration with the competing tangle of motivations in which no particular cause emerged as primary or sufficient. Recasting the novel through the voice of a third-person narrator, one who would be both inside of Raskolnikov and outside, mysteriously, though illogically, seems to have allowed Dostoevsky to embrace a completely different strategy for representing the problem of motivation. It liberated him from having to, quote, eliminate what is vague or from having to explain the whole murder in one way or another. Instead, for some unknowable reason, the mantle of a third-person narrator enabled him to embrace rather than seek to disentangle this chaos of motivation. The plenitude of motivations becomes, in its entirety, the substance of the novel and of Raskolnikov's character. Dostoevsky has thus returned to his first description of the work as about a young man who had, quote, yielded to the unfinished ideas in the air. The point is that those many unfinished ideas enter his being. No single idea can possibly emerge as the motivation for the murder. Konstantin Kluchkin, as art critic on the West Coast, has argued that, quote, the hot and suffocating air dominating the novel would have been apparent to the reader of the time. He quotes a very telling passage from a journal called Time, of which Dostoevsky was the main editor. Quote, summer heat and literary suffocation, imaginary theory, the need for fresh air. This is a passage, a journalistic passage. Petersburg summers are always suffocating, but people condemned to the studious reading of books, newspapers, and journals are especially stifled. They are engulfed by an ocean of empty speech, banality, falsehood, and meaningless phrases. He concludes, the characters of the novel are placed not only in the hot summer of 1865, but also in the stifling milieu of repetitive and non-referential speech proliferating in the press. Could Dostoevsky himself have been the author of this odd feuilleton, as he was of so many of the pieces in Time? I have no idea. If so, it would show the extent to which this theme of the linking of summer heat, literary suffocation, and stifling theory was already on his mind several years before he had even written to Kat Crawford, his hero who had succumbed to the unfinished ideas in the air. At any rate, once Dostoevsky had decided upon his third-person narration, he rapidly settled down to representing his hero's tragic duality rather than trying to resolve it. Frank's keen analysis posits a different rationale on Dostoevsky's part at this crucial juncture in his writing than the one I have just suggested. He writes, why Dostoevsky abandoned his story can only remain a matter for speculation, but one possibility is that his protagonist began to develop beyond the boundaries in which he had first been conceived. He goes on to allude to the perpetual quarrel in Dostoevsky criticism over whether the motives finally attributed to Raskolnikov are or are not contradictory. For Frank, and you have his essay there, I think, the series of different motivations Raskolnikov experiences do not represent character or logic contradictions or authorial struggles, but rather a coherent set of sequential is crucial here, metamorphoses that the hero undergoes, a metamorphosis that results from his gradually dawning grasp of the full implications of what he has done. Frank, then, sees the progressive series of Raskolnikov's motivations as emanating in a complex yet reasonable way from his character, whereas I find most compelling the fact that once Dostoevsky had shifted his narrative to the third person, he no longer needed to explain the whole murder in one way or another, but could instead give himself over to the portrayal of the simultaneous multiplicity of Raskolnikov's motivations, his yielding to those unfinished ideas, those viruses in the suffocating air, which all goes to show that each of us will have our own sense of this. Through the representation of the dialogic movement of Raskolnikov's thoughts, words, and deeds, juxtaposed to the same movements within the other major characters, Dostoevsky is able to convey how all these potential motivations for the crime are operative, while also counterposing them to the motivations of other characters. The actual narrative effect resembles far more an unruly conversation, replete with rude interruptions, silences, moments of not listening, moments of acute attentiveness. Dostoevsky could not possibly have rendered these characters with the same fullness while operating through the confines of a first-person narrative without resorting to cumbersome devices. Dostoevsky, however, remained consistently drawn to first-person narrative, even when he ultimately rejected it. His two first-person novels, The Insulted and Injured and The Adolescent, bear eloquent testimony to his Herculean struggles with the complexities of wielding a first-person narration in works that also possessed a broad canvas of characters and a plethora of events and subplots. These two novels are less read. They display they're very important. They display an episodic quality and a tendency to confusion, which undercuts their still substantial force. So to return to Crime and Punishment and the question of Raskolnikov's motivation, Dostoevsky seemed to have made two simultaneous decisions. First, he fundamentally shifted his authorial task, and hence the idea of the novel. No longer did he believe it was crucial to locate and represent the dominant motive for Raskolnikov's committing murder. He chose instead to portray the multivalence of the human personality, one who had yielded to the unfinished ideas in the air. Second, his profound reconfiguration of the idea behind the novel coincided with the shift in narrative point of view from first person to third. Now, let's turn to the beginning of the novel, part five, The Drift in Part One. The seven chapters of part one are crammed with dramatic action. I will touch briefly only on four, chapters two, three, four, and seven. It is unnerving to take stock of what I'm leaving out. Most glaringly, Raskolnikov's rehearsal of the crime, his dream about the horse, all things we'll talk about, I'm sure, his tears and prayer that he not commit murder, his detour through the Haymarket, not to mention all the rest of this novel and its many characters and plots. The first chapter begins abruptly and tersely with Raskolnikov's dramatic rehearsal or testing of the crime. So in chapter two, when he enters the seedy tavern and encounters Marmolada, readers whose appetite has already been whetted by what seems to be a riveting psycho-thriller of a novel soon to be complete with an investigator and an array of clues, false leads, shaky evidence, psychological theories, confessions, even a trial. Readers, you, I don't know, you may be frustrated by what seems to be a sudden and annoying slowing of the action, not to mention a boring digression foisted upon our hero and upon the reader by a loquacious drunk. Did any of you react that way? And there's Marmolada. At this point, if I'm talking about this novel with students, I frequently turn to a wonderful book called Dostoevsky by John Jones. And he writes, "And now to another petty clerk, Mr. Marmolada." He then goes on, quotes at length from a passage in the second chapter of the novel, in which Marmolada relates his story to Raskolnikov. And my students sometimes completely skip this. He observes, John Jones observes, "Many people will remember reading this for the first time. first time, perhaps in adolescence, and wondering what was happening to them. Marmolada comes from nowhere. He is a sideshow and gets no reflected interest from the main story of murder and detection. He looks like a retired clerk. He's dirty. He's been drinking. That's about all. The book has scarcely begun. He will be dead, though we aren't to know, long before halfway. He buttonholes Raskolnikov. He is a tavern bore. Then this voice, this is still John Jones, and a simultaneous onslaught on intellect and emotions that is more like being cuffed about by a god than reading a book. Cuffed about by a god. Well, this is an over-the-top statement, the kind that literary critics may shun, but that Oxford poets like John Jones are allowed. It, in fact, captures the effect that Dostoevsky can, at times, achieve when he decides to pull out all the stops. The narrative pitch in Marmoladov's long, drunken narrative is piercingly on-key. Jones mulls the reader's response here. What is it, for example, that stops the reader in his tracks and sends him reeling? No apparent work has gone into committing us to Raskolnikov, and there's no access at all to his wife except through the vodka haze of his story, at once gappy and repetitious and muffled, unquote. But it is precisely within that boozy narrative that we encounter the concise and tragic drama enacted by Katerina Ivanovna and Sonia, while Marmoladov, at once the cause of the tragedy and the incoherent chorus or witness to the action, as well as its narrator, all of these, lies blurrily on the floor. Indeed, in Dostoevsky's next novel, The Idiot, the Nastasia Philippovna, which is the heroine's tragic story, also first comes to us through the muddled narrative of another questionable character. Dostoevsky technique to good effect. A similar dynamic in which the reader's expectations are abruptly foiled is operative in the next two chapters, 3 and 4, in which, remember, Raskolnikov reads the letter from his mother? By now, and throughout chapter 3, readers, you, are perhaps more alert to the fact that a seeming digression or slowing of the action may in fact end by constituting a new intensity of plot, albeit embedded. The careful reader may find herself making what seem to be savvy analogies between the situations of Sonia and Dunya as you read the letter, and the relative willingness of Katerina Ivanovna and Raskolnikov's mother to accept such sacrifices. Not to mention the passive or absent male protagonists who seem to do no more than bear witness, grumble, lie on the floor, or potentially reap the material benefits of such sacrifice. Reading along, you may be feeling quite confident about your capacities to work with this text. You are an attentive reader. You're back in control. Yet, in chapter 4, Raskolnikov offers up his own deconstruction of his mother's letter. Raskolnikov very likely proves himself to be a far more astute reader than we are. He is willing to do more than make rough analogies. He pursues his thoughts to their logical moral conclusion. He asserts that the sacrifice his own beloved sister is willing to make is even more abhorrent than Sonia's turn to prostitution. He says, do you understand that a Mrs. Luzhin's cleanness is exactly the same thing as Sonichka's, or perhaps even worse, fouler, more despicable, because you, Dunichka, can after all reckon on comforts into the bargain, and with the other it is simply a question of dying or hunger. We are confronted by a character, a student, who whatever terrible acts he might commit, can make more perceptive judgments, can observe, can analyze himself and others better than we can. What then is our role as readers in this text? Are we merely spectators to the action, putty in the hands of both narrator and his protagonist? When the murders actually occur in chapter 7, a mere 20 pages or so later, we face yet another challenge, a moral and psychological rather than an intellectual one. Raskolnikov murders the old woman brutally. Quote, he struck her again and again with all all his strength, always with the blunt side of the axe, and always on the crown of the head. Blood poured out as if from an overturned glass, and the body toppled over on its back. Raskolnikov then begins rifling through the pawnbroker's possessions and pledges. A footstep sounds. These are the attempt measures for women. An even more grisly murder occurs. A murder that is, as Raskolnikov himself instantly realizes, a second unpremeditated murder. Then, relentlessly, comes the passage in which Raskolnikov, on one side of the hastily closed door, listens to the conversation between two young men who are almost stand-ins for Raskolnikov himself and also for the reader, the student Koch and a young man studying to be an examining magistrate. They rattle the door and speculate on why there is no answer to the bell, since the door has been bolted from the inside. At this juncture, did any of you find yourself hoping that Raskolnikov would escape his situation, or hoping that he would be caught? One page after reading a minute description of two horrendous murders, some readers may find themselves, against all better judgment, rooting for his escape. At this point, it is not an intellectual challenge that confronts readers, but a moral one. Some people, just some people. Why might we perhaps side with Raskolnikov? Why are we on his side of the door? Why do we make, if only momentarily, intellectual and moral judgments in fiction that we might not make in life? As readers, we continue to examine our own intellectual and moral assumptions, as well as those of the characters. Reading may be at risk, but it is also a very risky business. Finally, the final part, not as long as the previous one, trifles and blind spots. For much of the novel, Raskolnikov experiences a terrible certainty that he will be brought down by trifles, by the small things he forgets or cannot control. The fact that he leaves the door hanging open while he murders the pawnbroker is perhaps the first and most unnerving of these trifles. Yet it is one that, by virtue of its terrifyingly familiar, nightmarish quality, may help bind the reader's sympathy to Raskolnikov. Moreover, throughout much of the novel, Raskolnikov simply cannot seem to remember that he committed two murders, not one. Only once his interviews with Sonya have commenced does he begin to take into account that he has also murdered Lizaveta, and to absorb what the dreadful meaning of that terrible murder might be. Even worse, after he has overheard Lizaveta in the marketplace, Raskolnikov recalls the first time he had heard of her existence. He remembers a conversation between two students he had overheard 6 weeks earlier in a tavern just after his own first visit to the pawnbroker. At that time, he was struck by the coincidence that the students were speaking of the pawnbroker with the same loathing for her for which he also felt, and that, like him, they were infected by the Rastignac idea. But Raskolnikov is blind to what is perhaps the main point. He also hears that Lizaveta is constantly pregnant. Raskolnikov never returns to this recollection from before the murder again, never. Has Raskolnikov actually murdered a pregnant woman? What is the impact of this? Does he ever realize this possibility? Neither the narrator nor Raskolnikov ever returns to this subject, but perhaps it will remain activated in the minds of some readers. Such trifles and blind spots are the crux of the matter. In the notes for the novel, Dostoevsky explores the theme of Lizaveta's pregnancy more fully. He even occasionally suggests that she has a child. There is this curious entry, quote, "It happened this way with Sasya. He caresses Sasya, and she came to him, and it was clear that she herself was glad to have a pretext for coming. She said that she is the daughter of Lizaveta, and that she knew Lizaveta. When he admitted his guilt to her, then suddenly no Sasya." This same Sasya, Lizaveta's child, then appears at the Marmolados. A few paragraphs later, appears the following note, quote, "Child, oh, you lovable creature, this is Lizaveta. About Lizaveta, the baby, who will forbid me to love this baby? And suddenly, I am astonished why I don't pity really interesting in the notes is the suggestion that a character, Baka Bean, who is a prototype for Zasimov in the novel, may have been one of Lizaveta's lovers and made her pregnant. And there's this entry. He lived with Lizaveta, Nastasia blurted out as soon as he left. She did his wash for him. Also, he didn't pay her anything for it. No, it just isn't true at all, Razumihin cried out. She had someone else, I know. Well, maybe there was a third and perhaps a fourth, Nastasia said, laughing. She was a girl who tried to please. It's not that she herself had to. She did it by her own will, but she sort of bore it out of humility. She didn't know how to say no. Every mischief maker had fun with her, but the infant they found was his, the doctor's. What baby? But don't you know? They performed a cesarean on her. She was 6 months pregnant, a boy, born dead. When they left, I, Raskolnikov, fell on my back and caught hold of my head. We learned, too, that Lizaveta had mended in the novel Raskolnikov's shirt, and Sonya tells him that in the notebooks that he still owes Lizaveta 10 kopecks for mending. This is in the notebooks. You haven't paid it yet, and she was murdered pregnant. They used to beat her for nothing, and whoever wanted could outrage her. And then here's a sentence that he crossed out. I knew her, and she mended my linen. She's an idiot. The old woman beat her when she was pregnant. I saw it myself. Pregnant, pregnant, six. And all of that is crossed out. Now, Dostoevsky starkly brackets in the notebooks the significance of Raskolnikov's sudden recollection that he had killed Lizaveta as well as the old woman in the notebooks. He puts this out there. Nota bene, Lizaveta, Lizaveta, and why is it that I haven't thought of her a single time since then? It's not as if I had not killed her. Killed her. How horrible that really is. And then in the jottings for Raskolnikov's confession to Sonya, Dostoevsky has Raskolnikov tell her that he now thinks only of Lizaveta and not of the convoy. Quote, and it's curious, I do not think of the old woman, but only of Lizaveta. Poor Lizaveta. Now, not only does Dostoevsky remove all of this disturbing material about Lizaveta, about her being a mother, having a stillborn child, being more closely connected to Raskolnikov and Zasimov from the final version of the novel, he pares it down and condenses it into a single, powerful, minute particle of charged matter, the phrase constantly pregnant. At the beginning of the novel, before he has committed the murders, once Raskolnikov has overheard that Lizaveta was constantly pregnant, he never returns to the thought again, nor does the narrative. This trifle, this blind spot, once it's noticed by the reader, becomes a kind of trompe l'oeil. Once the reader has observed this unsettling detail, Raskolnikov's consistent failure to remember it becomes emblematic of the disconcerting trifles and blind spots that render this novel a metaphysical thriller as well as a proto-detective novel. So in conclusion, nearly everything is missing. I brought up no discussion of fantastic realism, of the polyphonic novel, of the dialogic imagination, of sideward or squinting glances, of thresholds, of coffin-like rooms, drenching rains. Nothing much about Marmolada, Sonya, Katerina Ivanovna, Dunya, Svidrigailov, Razumihin, and the magnificent Porfiry Petrovich. Nothing at all about Luzhin or Lebezyatnikov. Nothing about Dostoevsky's technique of doubling. Very little about dreams, about Napoleon, the architecture of St. Petersburg. About articles concerning crime. About the possibility of authentic confession or solid repentance. Not to mention nothing about five-year-old girls hiding behind cupboards, folded 100 ruble notes tucked into pockets, or watchmen named Achilles. Nothing about Dostoevsky's passionate and ongoing polemic with Rousseau, or about another odd detail, trifle, that when we first encounter Razumihin in part two, chapter two, he suggests to Raskolnikov that they should undertake a joint project of translating Rousseau. He says, there are some very boring pieces of gossip marked out in the second part of the Confessions, and we will translate them. Someone or other has told Haruvi Moth that Rousseau is in his way a sort of Radisha. Of course, I don't contradict him. He can go to the devil. Unquote. Well, this second part of Rousseau's Confessions was one of the foci for Dostoevsky's lifelong rage and emblematic to him of the problems inherent in any confession narrative. He was not a fan of Rousseau. The fact that Razumihin proposes this particular translation project is another essential trifle, another blind spot, another unexplored connection to the Rastignac idea, which ultimately finds its source in Rousseau's Confessions. There is nothing to do but to return to the text, its final words. Quote, all that might be the subject of a new tale, but our present moment is ended. Dostoevsky's life and his literary work abound with transformations and conversions. His starting point for this novel was, as we have seen, the theme of ideas in the air and how they came to enter the being of his hero. They transformed themselves and mutated in his psyche. And I think for us, this novel will literally become, as we discuss it over the next 2 days, an idea in the air. It unceasingly transforms itself. It mutates as it enters, also in unfinished form, the minds of us, its many readers, and in effect, us. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.